Hello, and welcome to the second episode of the Norwegian Sagas podcast. My name is Christian, and I'm here with my friend Charlie.
Greetings.
And I was thinking maybe before we get on to the next chapters, I could read a little bit from an article that came out recently, or a couple weeks ago now, based on the Vikings. So this article is in history.com. It's entitled, Hiker Discovers 1,200-Year-Old Viking Sword in Norway. The Norwegian mountain village of Hokkeli, located some 150 miles west of Oslo, is most commonly known for its fishing, hunting, skiing, and other outdoorsy attractions. Recently, however, Hokkeli made headlines as a location of the latest sensational archaeological find, a Viking sword blade dating back more than 1,200 years. While hiking across the mountain plateau that runs between western and eastern Norway, Goran Olsen sat down to take a break. That's when he spotted a rusty sword blade lying under some rocks on the well-traveled mountain path. Archaeologists have identified Olsen's find as a type of Viking sword made circa AD 750. That makes it some 1,265 years old, though the scientists have warned this is not an exact date. So I might not read the entire article, but
that's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's always...
That's really old, too.
It is,
like,
yeah.
most people talk about the Vikings maybe... Well, maybe around that time, actually, I guess so. Yeah, but this, I mean, the guy's just walking and he finds a sword.
It's under a rock and there it is.
Yeah, it seems too easy to be true.
There was another article, a few months ago. A recent article, in any case, about, I think, in some parking lot, they found... part of like some like a hall or something, and it was like, you know, like a mead hall parts, or was it something indicating that there was like at one point in time this very large building stood there. So that was also interesting. I mean,
just in the parking lot, and they'd already built over it.
Yeah, it was unfortunate.
Oh wow.
It was something like that.
Well, you always find those things. Well, maybe not in America, but in Europe, definitely. So, should we start? We ended with chapter 9, so we're going to begin chapter 10, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, just a quick recap. We read about the War of the Vanir and the Aesir, and Odin, and how he was, like, he was in the flesh at first, and then he died, and went into the heavens. And now, chapter 9 was Odin's death and burial, and we are going to start with chapter 10, Frey's reign of plenty. And just like to say, I'm here today. I just was too nervous last week. You know, the words weren't coming. I was excited, I was nervous, and what I wanted to say wasn't coming to me. But now... I've had time to think, and I'm ready to go. So,
yeah, don't worry about it. Like we said, this is completely for fun. So I will read the first chapter for today. So like Charlie said, chapter 10, Frey's reign of plenty. After Njörth, Frey succeeded to power. He was called King of the Swedes and received tribute from them. He was greatly beloved and blessed by good seasons like his father. Frey erected a great temple at Uppsala and made his chief residence there, directing to it all tribute due to him, both lands and chattels. This was the origin of the Uppsala crown goods, which have been kept up ever since. In his days, there originated the so-called Peace of Frothi. There were good harvests at that time in all countries. The Swedes attributed that to Frey, and he was worshipped more than any other gods because in his days, owing to peace and good harvests, the farmers became better off than before. His wife was called Girth, the daughter of Gymir. Their son was Fjörnir. Frey was also called Yngvi, and the name of Yngvi was for a long time afterwards kept in his line as a name for kings, and his race were therefore called Ynglings. Frey took sick, and when the sickness gained on him, his followers hit upon the plan to let few men see him. And they threw up a great burial mound with a door and three windows. And when Frey was dead, they carried him secretly into the mound and told the Swedes that he was still alive, and kept him there for 3 years. With all the tribute they poured into the mound, gold by one window, silver by another, and copper coin by the third, thus good seasons and peace endured. Freya kept up the sacrifices, for she was the only one among the godheads who survived. Therefore she became most famous, so that all women of rank came to be called by her name. They are now called Fruver, or ladies. Thus everyone who is a mistress over her property is called Freya. And who's Freya, lady of the house? One who owns an estate. Freya was rather fickle-minded. Her husband was called Oth, and her daughters, Hnoss and Grissimi, they were very beautiful, and we give their names to our most precious possessions. When all Swedes knew that Freya was dead, but that good seasons and peace still prevailed, they believed this would be the case so long as Freya was in Sweden. And so they would not burn him and called him the god of the world, and sacrificed him ever after for good harvests and peace.
Chapter 11. King Fjolnir drowns in a mead vat. Thereafter, Fjolnir, the son of Yngvafre, had sway over the Swedes and the Uppsala crown goods. He was powerful. There were good harvests and peace obtained during his reign. At the same time, Peace Frothi ruled in Hleithrar, and there was friendship between them, and they invited one another to feasts. Invited one another to feasts. Once, when Fjolnir went to visit Frothi on the island of Saeland, a great banquet had been prepared, and many had been invited from near and far. Frothi had a large estate, and a vat had been built there, many ells high and reinforced by stout timbers. It stood on the lower floor of a storehouse, and above it was a balcony with an opening in the floor, so that liquids could be poured down and mead mixed in it. An exceedingly strong drink had been prepared. In the evening, Fjolnir and his retinue were led to lodgings in a loft close by. During the night, he went out on the balcony to find a place to relieve himself. He was drowsy with sleep and dead drunk, and on his way back to his lodgings, he went along the balcony into the wrong loft door, and through it, he missed his footing and fell into the mead vat and drowned. As says Thjodolf of Hivnir, doom of death where dwelled Frothi fulfilled was on Fey Fjolnir, and in mead measures spacious windless wave the warrior died.
Where are we? Chapter 12?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll read chapter 12. Yep. Chapter 12. King Svigithir is lured into a rock by a dwarf. Svigithir succeeded to the throne after his father. He made a vow that he would try to find God, Home, and Othin the Old. With 11 others, he fared wily around about the world. He came to the land of the Turks, Sverdjorth the Great. There he met many of his kinsmen. He was 5 years on this journey. Then he returned to Sweden and remained at home for a while. In Vanerland, he had married a woman named Vanna. Their son was Vanlandi. Svigthir set out again to look for Godhom. In the eastern part of Sweden, there is a large estate called Stein. There stands a boulder as big as a house, as a large house. In the evening after sunset, when Svigthir went from the feast to his sleeping quarters, he saw that a dwarf was sitting by the boulder. Svigthir and his men were very drunk and ran toward the boulder. The dwarf stood in the doorway of the rock and called to Svigthir, inviting him to enter in if he would see Othin. Svigthir ran in, and the rock at once closed after him, and he never came out again, as says Throthulf and of Vanir. Daylight shy Durni's kinsman, the rock's warder, wild King Svigthir. After him, when hastened the thane, Fjornir's son, Sion of Godheads, and that hall, hewn by Itins, swallowed up Svigthir the king.
Chapter 13. King Vanlandi engenders a son in Finland and is killed by a nightmare. Vanlandi was the name of Svigthir's son succeeded him and ruled over the Uppsala crown goods. He was a great warrior and fared far and wide from country to country. He accepted an invitation to pass the winter in Finland with Snare, or Snow, the Old, and there he married his daughter Drifa, Snowdrift. But in the spring he departed, leaving Drifa behind. He promised to return after 3 years, but did not within 10 years. Then Drifa sent for Huld, a sorceress, and sent Visbur, her son by Vanlandi, to Sweden. Drifa prevailed upon Huld by gifts that she should conjure Vanlandi back to Finland or else kill him. At the time when she exercised her sorcery, Vanlandi was at Uppsala. Then he became eager to go to Finland, but his friends and counselors prevented him from doing so, saying that most likely it was the witchcraft of the Finns which caused his longing. Then a drowsiness overcame him, and he lay down to sleep. But he had hardly gone to sleep when he called out, saying that a nightmare rode him. His men went to him and wanted to help him, but when they took hold of his head, the nightmare trod on his legs so they nearly broke, and when they seized his feet, it pressed down on his head so that he died. The Swedes burned him by a river called Skuta, and there they erected memorial stones for him. As says Thjothulf of Hvinir, a vile witch caused Vanlandi to visit Vili's brother. When that trod the troll woman, wicked wench, the warrior king, was he burned on bank of Skuta, noble prince, whom the nightmare killed.
Chapter 14. King Vishur's sons burn him in his hall. Vishur was the heir of his father, Vanlandi. He got in marriage with the daughter of Athi the Wealthy, and for her bridal gift gave her 3 large estates and a gold necklace. They had 2 sons, Gisil, Ski Staff, and Ander, Ski. But Visbur deserted her and got himself another wife. So she returned to her father with her 2 sons. Visbur had a son called Dimaldi. Dimaldi's stepmother inflicted harm on him through sorcery. When the sons of Visbur were 12 and 13 years old, they came upon him and demanded from him their mother's bridal gifts, but he would not yield them up. Then they said that the gold necklace would be the death of the best man in his line. Thereupon they left him and returned home. Then another incantation was chanted to enable them to kill their father. Then Huld, the sorceress, told them she would bring it about, but also that there would always be slaughter of kinsmen in the race of the Skeldings. They agreed to that. Then they gathered a host and fell upon Visbur unawares at night and burned him in his hall, as says Thurjokolf. And Visbur's vault of wishes, Aegir's Sib, swallowed Fornwith. When the thrones theft avengers on their farther, the fire did turn, and the Gleed's greedy dog bit the liege lord, loudly howling.
Chapter 15. King Dumaldi is sacrificed for better seasons. Dumaldi succeeded his father, Visbur, and ruled over his lands. In his days there was famine and starvation in Sweden. Then the Swedes made huge sacrifices in Uppsala. The first fall they sacrificed oxen, but the season did not improve for all that. A second fall they sacrificed humans, but the season remained the same, or was even worse. In the third fall, the Swedes came in great numbers to Uppsala at the time for the sacrifices. Then the chieftains held a council, and they agreed that the famine probably was due to Dumaldi, their king, and that they should sacrifice him for better seasons, and that they should attack and kill him and redden the altars with his blood. And so they did, as says Thjothulf. The time was when weapon-bearing Swedes reddened their soil with blood of their liege. Lifeless lay then Dumaldi, dead in his blood, when that him harvest-eager his folk gave as gift to gods.
Chapter 16. King Domer dies of a malady. Doma was the name of Donaldi's son, and he succeeded to the kingdom. His rule was a long one. Good seasons and peace prevailed in his days. Nothing more is told about him than that he died in Uppsala of a sickness. His body was brought to Fyrisvillir and was burned there by the river, and there stand his memorial stones, as says Thidrolf. Oft had I, about Yggdrasil's Sib, vainly asked the wisest men where Domor's his dead body had been borne. On Half's bale fire. Now I know not by disease, Bjorn's kin by fury burned.
Chapter 17. King Digvi dies of a sickness. Digvi was the name of his son, who ruled the land after him, and nothing more is told about him than that he died of a sickness. As says Thiothulf, I doubt not but Digvi's corpse held his hold to whore with him. For Ulf Sib, a scion of kings by right, should caress in death, to love Lord Loki's sister, Yngvi's heir, o'er all Sweden. The mother of Digvi was Drott, the daughter of King Damb, the son of Rig, who was the first to be called king in the Danish tongue. His kinsmen have ever since borne the title of king as that of the highest rank. Digvi was the first of his line to be called king. Before that, they were called Drottnar, their spouses Drottningar, and the king's men Drott. But everyone in their line was always called Yngvi or Ingunni, and all of them Ynglings. Queen Drott was the sister of King Dan the Proud, after whom Denmark is named.
Where are we here? Ah, right. Chapter 18. King Deg seeks revenge for his sparrow and is slain. Dag was the name of King Digvi's son, who succeeded to the kingdom. He was so wise that he understood the speech of birds. He had a sparrow which told him many tidings. He used to fly over various countries. One time this sparrow flew into Withgaland, into the farm called Vorvi. He flew to the field of a farmer and fed them. The farmer came up and seized a stone and killed the bird. King Dad felt greatly concerned when the sparrow did not return to him. He prepared a sacrifice, offering up a boar to fry to find out what had happened, and received the answer that his sparrow had been killed at Vorvi. Then he summoned a large fleet and proceeded to Gotland. And when he arrived at Vorvi, he debarked with his army and harried there. The people fled in all directions. In the evening, King Dag returned with his army to the ships after having slain many and taken many prisoners. But as they were crossing some river at a place called Skithfordsford, or Vapnaford, a work slave ran out of the woods on the riverbank and hurled a pitchfork into their flock. It struck the king on his head, and he fell straightway from his horse and was dead. In those days, a chieftain on a harrying expedition was called Gram, and his men Gramir. As says Thidrolf, here I have that high-born Dag to death doomed, undaunted came to revenge on Vorvi strand, with spear armed, his sparrow's loss, and eke that in the eastern lands the king's host of combat told, that this Dane by thrown hay fork from Hind's hands to hell should fare.
Chapter 19. King Agni's hanged by Skelf to avenge her father's death. Agni was the name of Dag's son, who was king after him, a famous man of much power, a great warrior, and a man of many accomplishments in every way. One summer, King Agni proceeded to Finland with his fleet, landing and harrying there. The Finns collected a great force to oppose him. The name of their leader was Frosty. A great battle ensued, and King Agni was victorious. Frosty had a great many others fell there. King Agni harried far and wide in Finland, subjecting it and making enormous booty. He took Skelf, Frosty's daughter, prisoner, and carried her away together with Logi, her brother. And when he returned west, he anchored in Stock Sound and erected his tents on the meadow south of it. A forest was there at that time. King Agni had, with him the golden necklace which had belonged to Visper. King Agni proceeded to marry Skelf. She prayed the king to make a funeral feast for her father, so he invited many men of note and celebrated a great feast. He had become most famous through his expedition. Then there was a great drinking bout, and when King Agni had become drunk, Skelf asked him to take care of the necklace he wore, so he seized it and bound it fast to his neck before he went to sleep. His tent stood close by the forest with a high tree over it to shield it against the sun's heat. Now when King Agni had fallen asleep, Skelf took a thick cord and fastened it to the necklace. Then her followers took down the tent post and threw the coil of the rope over the limbs of the tree and then pulled so that the king hung high in the branches. And that was the death of him. Skelf and her men ran to a boat and rowed away. King Agni's body was burned there, and the place was later called Agnafit. It is east of Tower and west of Stocksound, as says Theothulf. Marvel wort if Agni's men did not scout Queen Skelf's scheme when Logi's Sib lifted aloft the good king by golden torque and hanged him high neath heaven like Signy's lover on gallows.
Chapter 20. King Alric and Eirik kill each other. Alric and Eirik were the names of Agni's sons who were kings after him. They were men of great power, great warriors, and skilled in all arts. It was their habit to ride horses, training them both for pacing and racing. They were exceedingly skillful in this. They vied with each other who was the better horseman and who had the better mounts. One time both the brothers rode away from their followers on their best horses. They traversed some level lands and did not return. A search was made for them and both were found dead, with their heads battered. They had had no weapons besides the bridle bits of their horses, and it was believed they had killed each other with them. As says Thjodolf. Fell Alric where Eirik too breathed his last, by brothers slain with racers' reins. Men said that Dag's kinsmen killed each other. Unheard wasn't that with horses' bits Freya's offspring fought each other. Okay, so that's chapter 20, the end of chapter 20. So I think we're good for today.
All right. Yeah.
It seems back then being a king was not a very good thing to be. Every single chapter's like, well, this happened, and then he died.
Yeah,
but really,
know,
quickly too.
Like every other, well, just about every saga is like that. You know, it tells of a great man and who had a, you know, tells of his sons and then just how they all died.
Yeah, it seems like the greatest kings though are the ones that they talk less about. Like the ones that were the best kings is like they were great harvests, and then they died. So that says like a. They rated a king of how well the crops was because farming was so important to them back then.
Yeah.
And B, if there was peace, there was nothing to talk about. So it was good. The people with the longest the longest accounts are the bad ones often back then.
You know, I also like the writing style of these sagas. So it's all just to the point.
Yeah.
It tells you what you need to know. Like in that one chapter. That the one king who died of a sickness. All you need to know is that he died. He died of a sickness. It doesn't bother telling you what the sickness was.
Yeah.
Just is all you need to know. He died, and you move on.
Do you think these stories have moral meanings to them, especially the ones about alcohol? It seems like they drink alcohol, and it's like if you drink too much alcohol, you're gonna die.
Oh sure, yeah. No, there's sure a lot can be. Learned from reading these sagas, not only on a historical and cultural basis, but what they valued and how they thought. Which, you know, it's important to read these sagas because it gives you another look on the culture of the Vikings. And for me, paganism has two sides to it. Sure, like, a lot of my friends just read about the gods and the myths, And a lot of them can just say what the gods did in the stories. But there's so much more to paganism than that. There's their faith and their religion is one side to it. The other side is their culture and how their culture interacted with those myths. They go together. They influence each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a look at that other side in reading these sagas. So I think it's very important for someone who's interested in paganism or the Norse paganism to read these sagas.
Or Swedes in this case,
too. The Swedes, yeah.
Yeah, it's also, if say these stories actually were like, have some hint of truth of their original meaning before they were written down. It's interesting if it was interesting how they created their like moral framework. Like they invented alcohol for the first time, and then they like they really liked it. They used it for celebration, and that's like a common thing across the world.
Mead was a very important drink, not just to the Vikings, but it was consumed by lots of different peoples in many different parts of the world. For some people, it was a sacred drink. It was called ambrosia, the nectar of the gods.
Yeah.
So, but if you're gonna drown, then drown in a tub of mead.
Yeah, I mean that reminds me of again relating to Chinese history. There's two kings who get really really powerful, and what do they do with their money? They build a gigantic pool of alcohol, so they can swim in it, and then they die because like they become obsessed. So. There is definitely like a point where like these cultures are just like, oh, we love alcohol,
yeah, alcohol
but you need to be careful with it. So that's like remained from the beginning of time. So I also liked how they included that they went to go voyaging and they found the Turks. So these aren't like the Turks weren't living like where they in Turkey, they were living like Central Asia almost back then. But even if this was written in the 1200s. And that's pretty amazing that they, because the Turks by the 1200s were living, had a lot of the main Turks had moved out of Central Asia down to Iran. So if these people knew, if writing it, do they know, if they were like filling in the blanks when they were writing this down, how do they know that the Turks used to live up there? Or maybe they looked at some other older accounts, or maybe they actually had passed down the history from the old histories, and now they're writing it down. The people, the old Norwegians, actually knew that the Turks used to live there. But that's amazing. We didn't have like Wikipedia back then, or even like any way to figure out where other people lived and to give them names and everything.
The Vikings, they did their traveling. They did interact with a lot of different peoples.
Yeah, unless that's just a translation in the book and it has a different name. And when somebody wrote it, they're like, okay, let's see what were these people, and they translated it. But what else do we have? We had the sparrow story. Maybe that's also a story about domestication of animals for the first time.
Could be.
I don't know. Maybe he didn't actually talk to animals. Maybe he just like learned how to train a sparrow.
Maybe. There's a lot of things in there that, I'd like to touch upon. At the end of just about every chapter, there's those little poetic bits.
Yeah.
There's also, they mentioned the chapter with the nightmare in it. So it's like they're more of, I guess, superstitious beliefs, not like monsters that don't directly relate to their main pantheon, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's talk poetry for a moment.
So like, this Heimskringla is not the original book. There were books before it, some that we don't even have all the information of. But if you look at the there's another book called Morkinskinner, which is a couple hundred years earlier. And in some ways, it actually has more details in some areas. And it relies on poetry a lot more. Like every couple paragraphs is a poem. Because that was like their version of footnotes. Like,
it was also just like very popular, maybe even important art.
Yeah, so like someone close to the king would be given the role of a poet. Like poetry was so important back then. Someone would have to memorize poetry, and the poetry would be used for history, but also for memorizing the law. And so when when he was writing, when Snorri was writing this down, he'd know all these poems, or maybe there was other versions of them written down, and he used them, and he's like taking them all together and trying to piece together a story.
Sure, yeah. Actually, while I was at Ramapo, I had a poetry class, and we had a project that was pretty, really open-ended. So I did a little research on different types of meter in Norse poetry, and I got to present that to the class. I attempted to read some snippets of Norse poetry.
In Norse or English?
In Norse.
Nice.
A lot of blank stares from the class.
What did the teacher say?
I got a C on the project.
Oh, darn it. So at least you cared about it.
At least one of my friends was like, hey, at least I got to hear you try to read Norse at
Yeah, you have a passion for what you want to do, so, what you like.
But from off the top of my head, I can remember a few different types of meters. There's one called Leodahatr, Malahatr, and Drottkvight, something like that anyway. And these meters were written, were written for different purposes. The first one I mentioned, I think that was, if I remember correctly, it was more of just a casual meter.
Mm-hmm.
Drottkvight, I think, was for like really special or grand occasions. It was for the king.
Yeah, you know, it's like a feast or something.
Poems written for the king. And the other one, I think, it was some, not as important as that, but it was still, its importance was greater than the casual one. And all these meters, like they were really difficult, especially Drottkvight. I don't remember the rules off the top of my head, but I remember reading them, and it was one of the most complicated poetic meters I've ever read about. Like, a popular thing with old poetry is half lines. You know, mm-hmm. like you have a line, but that line is broken up into two parts.
Okay.
And like each half line has to have a certain number of syllables and certain like alliterations, and then the end of that half line has to alliterate with the beginning of the next. You know, it's just all this really complicated stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember reading that a really, like, a true skald, the bard, you know. If a skald was skilled enough, and if he was knowledgeable in his language enough and in that art form, then he could make up a verse of that on the spot.
Hmm.
I found it incredible. I read that sometimes, like, There was a Norse version of like a rap battle where they just spew out poetry at each other. You know, it's incredible. This is what I mean. Like, this is what I meant by saying that it's important to read these sagas, because it adds detail, it adds color to this culture. You know.
Yeah, the poet was like the cabinet of the king, like the right hand man of the king. Mm. Like, he just traveled around the country with him, making poems about what the king did. So he was like a journalist and like the secretary of state combined into one.
What a great job.
Yeah, now poetry is like, good luck making money off that, really.
And this, I love old, well, ancient medieval poetry, because it, to me, it truly reflects an art form.
Yeah.
Well, just about all the other poetry I read in college, it was just like each individual author was just doing whatever he or she wanted to do.
This was like a culture and a poem. Like, yeah. And it shows that they were definitely really, really intelligent. They're a lot more intelligent than you think a Viking. Vikings
sure.
were like,
absolutely,
kill, kill, kill. These people were actually pretty intelligent. And that's probably where they got most of our language comes from. Like, maybe the poet's like, okay, I need to rhyme here, but there's no word, so let's make up a word. And lots of those words maybe come from that. Another, Shakespeare even invented loads of words.
Oh, sure, cause. Yeah. Another part of Norse poetry that I really enjoy are the kennings. just fancier ways of saying something simple. Like, for instance, I don't know, the sun could be called the sky candle, or just something like that. I saw a kenning for Odin's spear, and it was just a slaughter shaft. That was kind of funny, but, you know.
And names don't, these days when people give people names, they don't have enough meaning. Like, back in the day, like, there was a thunderstorm today, so I'm going to call you blah, 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 blah. Or, like, today it rained, or we were at the by the ocean today, so I'm going to call you this name, because it means by the ocean or something.
Sure, yeah.
But now people are just like, well, I know about 20 boys' names, which one do I like the best? You know? So, yeah, names have lost kind of their meaning, so at least in English.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Norse poetry, though, I enjoy it a lot in the kennings.
Anything else?
The nightmare I mentioned, it just shows they feared these other, you know, kind of like people today are afraid of ghosts, things like that. There aren't many, well, as far as I know, there aren't too many sagas that involve, you know, those kind of ghouls and specters and whatnot. But in this particular chapter that we read with the nightmare, there was a footnote calling it, comparing it to a succubus. But I suppose this particular monster, I guess, is a bit more, it's more aggressive than a succubus, because it was like, you know, attacking this guy in his bed.
Let's talk about the Lapps, the people from like the north who are magicians and sorcerers and stuff. The Finns, actually, they call them.
The Finns, yes.
But
yes.
I'm not sure if they mean the ancestors of the Finns, or there's another word for the Lapps, or the Sami, because the Sami are usually the ones.
They're like related to each other.
Yeah. Probably.
But no, that was interesting, because Finland, while it's like in Scandinavia, it's like its own thing.
Yeah, here it's they're going further north into like the more scary parts of the world.
That the people of Finland have their own culture and their own gods, and the language is entirely different.
Yeah. I mean, there's like accounts from like Greeks and Romans who traveled up north, and their stories are like even more far-fetched. Like, the further north you go, the more crazy creatures there are, because like they all see it as like, I don't know, just a mystical land where no one lives. They're just crazy people.
Sure.
I mean, back then, why would people live in the coldest parts of the world? They had no electricity or heating, but they decided to live up there. I don't know.
Yeah.
So.
But then it'd be interesting to read more about Vikings interactions with the Finns.
I don't think there's much, though, because there's only like snippets where it's like he married a magician, a sorcerer's daughter or something.
I'm sure there's probably something here and there you can
pick up on.
Read about. Yeah, pick up on. Another thing, there are a couple of other kind of creatures that the Vikings feared. There's one, they were both undead. One, I forget the exact name of this one, but all I know is that it's an undead hag that rides a wolf that used snakes as reins. I've read that in another saga, and that was one of the coolest things I've ever read. That sounded really awesome to me. Also, there's the Draugr, which are not like the Skyrim video game Draugr. The real Norse Draugr are terrifying. They can do just about anything just because. I was reading another saga where there were birds flying over its crypt, and they were just dying because its presence was so strong. Huh. So there's just a pile of dead animals on the ground.
The imagination back then. Now that we just take from their stories and like, you know, use their creatures again and again, we don't invent our own.
Things get, you know, they get recycled a lot.
Yeah, I guess we have like Harry Potter's creatures they invent, but they're even still based on old stuff.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well. So, yeah, we're coming up to 40 minutes. So, I think that's long enough for today. I think the last one was 40 minutes, too. So
maybe a bit around there, maybe a bit longer.
Yeah. But we have next time to talk about more stuff. I'm pretty sure the same stuff will come up again. Or similar stuff, so.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for joining us today. Please join us next time if you liked it. Where we will read chapters 21 to 30, I think. Or maybe 21 to 31. Another 10. But yeah, thank you, and have a good evening, or a good morning, or good afternoon, wherever, whenever you're listening to this. So, farewell. Goodbye.